Okay, so we're going to be talking about compassion in living and dying today. So I want to just talk generally first what compassion is, because there's a lot of misunderstanding about the meaning of compassion. Especially nowadays, we think compassion and codependency are synonymous. Which is a real big mistake, I think, in our culture. From a Buddhist sense, compassion is simply the wish for others to be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. And it's a feeling, an attitude that we want to extend towards all living beings, not just towards the people that we care about. No, because if we just extend it towards the people we care about, it becomes very partial, very limited. But if we can open our hearts to extend compassion also to strangers and also to people who we don't like or who we disagree or disapprove of, then our compassion, I think, becomes really strong. Because to extend our compassion to all beings, we have to let go of our own wish to receive anything in return. We have to let go of all the strings that we so normally attach to our compassion and to doing things for other people. So I think true compassion is something that we work towards, that we build up over a period of time. We take the compassion we have now and gradually extend it. So, and also to be in touch with other people's suffering and to wish them to be free of that, we have to first of all be in touch with our own suffering and our own problems and our own difficulties. Because often we think that if we really have compassion for others, then it means that we neglect ourselves or ignore ourselves. You know, I'm not important, I'm just going to take care of the whole world. But I think really to actually tune in to other people's suffering, we have to be very clear what our own problems and distress and pain are. And really feel those in a very deep way. And learn to accept them, learn to deal with those things, and then recognize that everybody else is exactly like us, having the same wish for happiness, the same wish to be free of pain and suffering. And so, you know, in that way, we develop compassion for our own selves because we're able to face our suffering and not run away from it. And also compassion for other people because we realize that there's no essential difference between them and us. Now, one of the things that causes us a lot of pain in our life, you know, and pain, of course, is the source of, you know, the compassion, in that we have compassion for our pain and others' pain. One of the things that causes so much pain is the fact that things are transitory. Things don't last long. From the time we're conceived in our mother's womb, we're constantly changing. And so that change can be a source of joy. When a child grows up into an adult, often that change is a source of joy. But change can also be a source of tremendous pain. Not so much because the change, something's wrong with the change, but because our mind doesn't adapt very well to change. Our mind fights change. Yeah, we're struggling constantly in our life to make everything stable, to make everything secure, to feel like we got a handle on it and we know what's going on. And no sooner do we feel like we're kind of getting there, and something changes. And the thing is that the change happens in ways that we don't expect. Lots of times we plan our change. I'm going to change jobs. I'm going to change houses. Okay? But we don't plan change like I'm going to get sick or my partner's going to die. You know, those changes we don't plan. And in fact, we spend a lot of time not wanting to think about those. But they're part of our life. They're a natural part of our life, the fact that everything's changing, and the fact that most of this change is something that's beyond our control. So the change itself isn't the problem, but our mind that that has difficulty with the change, that attitude, that mind, is the source of a tremendous amount of grief and distress. Because we don't want the change to happen, or we want to be able to control it, and we can't. But there it is, and it's happening, and we can't control it. So the thing is, if we can change our attitude, if we can change our mind so that we can deal with the change, with the transitoriness, the impermanence, then there's a chance to be able to ride the waves of the things happening in our life rather than get panicky and nervous and want to control it and plan it out and make it be the way we want it to be. Okay. So we're going to spend a lot of time today looking at change and the effect it has on us, how we react to it, the physical signs of change as we approach death, the change that happens in terms of the grief process that it instigates, and then try and bring compassion and understanding to all of these things.
I'd like to spend some time talking about the physical components of change and also some of the psychological ones as we approach death. It can be kind of hard to talk this one through, especially if we're working with someone who is very ill, or if you are ill yourself, and this information is coming to you on a much more personal level. And actually, all the information I'm going to talk about may happen to every single one of us in the room, that if we go through an extended dying process, this very well may be the picture that we all have. And I want you to know that this material can be tough to listen to. And if you do find yourself kind of tightening or feeling a little uncomfortable, remember impermanence, this will end too, that we're going to move on to another topic. So I don't want to turn this into a real serious discussion, but there's some serious things that happen to people when they're getting close to the end, that we all have incredibly vital lives, and it's a lot of work to get out of your body, that it's very often very hard work, and that people go through a lot of transitions and often a lot of pain that's part of this process. So I think it's important for us to know about it, but again, it's sometimes a little tough. I usually break down the dying process into four components, and this is just my own kind of sense about it. I don't think this is something that is in the literature yet in this order, but I look at it from the standpoint of weakness, withdrawal, changes in control, and then the active dying phase. The weakness is probably the one that starts the soonest, that as someone develops a terminal illness or a very serious illness, they may go through a long period of time where they're really doing well, that they're marching around, they're going to the grocery store, they're going out to dinner and doing all these things. But at some point, they start getting weaker, that they start noticing that their body is just starting to slow down and that they don't have the stamina that they did before. And this process can take a long time, or it can be a very short time. There's no real timeline on it. And even within certain disease processes, there's a lot of difference. Lung cancer, AIDS, colon cancer, they all are very different. It depends on the person's vital structure, their age, their cardiovascular system, all that good stuff. So there's a lot of variation there. But as they come to the closer to the end, the weakness becomes much more profound, that they may not be able to get out of bed without assistance. And one of the real classic signs is they start to fall for no reason at all. They may be in the bathroom shaving, and all of a sudden they just go to ground. They just crump. And it could be that they're getting up in the middle of the night to walk to the bathroom, and they turn a corner, and they lose their balance and go down. And they've never done it quite like that before. This spontaneous kind of just falling. That may be about 2 weeks before the end. That's real general, real general. That's not an exact, there is no real exact science in terms of the predictions, but that's often the case. The weakness also affects other muscle structures. The most easily identifiable one is the lower extremities, the legs. Those become extremely weak. But also the swallowing gets very weak. That often as people come to the end, they lose what's called the gag reflex. that causes us to choke when something goes down the wrong pipe, that stops working, or they just don't have the muscle strength in their throat to swallow. And to be honest, this is probably one of the most painful part of being with someone who's dying when you love them. Because what this means is they're not going to be taking food and fluids anymore. It means that their body has gotten to the point where they cannot take nourishment. And what we think of in the society is we have high holy days, and what do? We get together and eat. The minimum of care, we think, is to feed somebody. You know, we have the, well, I go to children's house and she says, eat, eat, eat. You know, that's what we do. So when someone is most vulnerable and we can't feed them, what happens to us inside? We feel inadequate. We feel like we're not able to do it right. And so we immediately jump into this thing that says IV hydration, gastric tubes, all kinds of invasive procedures. We have to do this. We can't let them die of starvation. But we must always remember that the body's doing this the way God or whatever force intended. Bodies are designed very, very well. And part of the reason that people stop taking food and fluids is part of the dying process. It's part of a natural process. And if we start forcing fluids on somebody that is at that point, very often it causes a lot of difficulty, a lot of very hard symptoms to work with. One of them being is that they start getting what's called pulmonary edema, that the fluid just doesn't go through the system because the heart isn't strong, and the fluid backs up and goes to the lungs, and they have more trouble breathing. That's the most common problem with IV hydration. And I don't want to say that hydration is always bad, because that's not the case. There are specific times when it's good. But the body is also very smart and does things in a very wise way. And sometimes that's the case, and letting someone dehydrate can be a real good idea. In terms of the withdrawal aspects, that can be more interesting, actually, because what happens is people start to pull away from the world. Is that when we're healthy, when we're real active, we have circles of friends and acquaintances that go around us. And we've got our inner circle, our inner core, and that may be our family, our children, our spiritual teacher, it could be people in our church, but people that we have real close to us. And then there's another layer that's a little farther out that's still good friends, but they're not going to be our first confidant. And then there's other layers that have all kinds of different people, and some of them are the checkers at Safeway, and they can be the bus driver and whoever else. As people come toward the end, they naturally start cutting those circles down, that they stop worrying about Christmas cards to everybody, that they start just naturally cutting those people down. And pretty soon the circle is pretty small. And sometimes that circle can be kind of odd because they may include people that you didn't think would be included. For example, a paid caregiver may be part of that inner confidant circle, but the partner's not. And that can cause a lot of pain, because if the partner or the wife or the husband or the mother or the son is not in that circle, what does that mean about the relationship? But this is about the withdrawal process. It's about needing to step out of life in bits and pieces. When you think about laying down, going to bed, and saying, this is it, this is the last time I'm going to breathe, what are you going to miss? I mean, when I first did that meditation, the first thing that came to my mind is, I'll miss coffee. I think I'll have another cup of coffee before I do this. But after I started doing this more often, what I found is that I would miss, you know, my husband, I'd miss my friends, I'd miss my cats, I'd miss sunsets. There's a lot of life that we have to give up before we die. And so people do it in steps, that they withdraw in steps. They say goodbye to things, either literally or figuratively or symbolically, in little bits and pieces. And that's part of the withdrawal. So if someone rejects a partner or a spouse or a very close friend at the end, it may mean that the attachment is so great they need to pull back a little bit at a time. So it actually may be more of a statement of how much they love that person, and that the person that they're attaching to, like a paid caregiver, is actually safer because the attachment isn't so deep. often communication changes and they withdraw from normal communication. And we often call this confusion. Oh, they're just confused. It's too much morphine. It's too much something. But often the communication is on a very different plane. It's in a very different wording. And it's very special, actually. That very often people will start to say things in symbolic messages. They'll say, I've got to get home. I've got to get home. And you say, you are home. No, I've got to get home. Well, they're talking about a different kind of home very often. Sometimes they will talk about a roadmap. I had one man who was just panicky. He had to find the suitcase. He couldn't find that suitcase, and he had to have it. And there's lots of other messages, and sometimes they're visual also. I had one woman who saw a staircase going up in the corner of the room, and there was a chalk line in front of it that she saw was being erased. And I don't think she was on much morphine at all, so I know it wasn't that kind of a hallucination, but it was a hallucination or a vision of what she thought she was going into. And it's also a message to us that something is changing. And that it may be a message that the time is getting closer. So if you have an opportunity to hear someone talk like that, listen up tight, because it's very special. It's incredibly special. And the kind of communication that can occur can leave you real breathless. We had one little pediatric patient, a three-year-old, who was dying very fast. And he went up to his mother and said, the magic is leaving my fingers. And he died in 3 days. So it was a very special way of letting us know what's happening to them. And I kind of lump that into the withdrawal because it's kind of withdrawing from communication as we know it. The other kinds of withdrawal are they withdraw from the conscious world. They sleep more. Very often people will start sleeping 16, 18, 20 hours a day, maybe only awake for a few minutes at a time. And their dreams may change in that period. They may have real, interesting, very vivid dreams. Sometimes they're scary dreams, but more often than not, they're very pleasant. The control issues that change are also pretty interesting because they often want the room controlled in very specific ways. And the reason for that is that they have no control of their body, and so let's control the environment. And we ought to respect it. That if someone says we have to have the bed here, and we have to have the light here, and we have to have it this, 25 watts, not a 40 watt, well, great, let's do it. Because when you can't control your body, you really try to control other things. And if you can't control your breathing, you often try to get other people to do the work for you. So there's often personality changes that we see. And part of compassion is understanding what is happening on the body level so that we can understand what's happening on the head level and help out that way. When people reach the active dying phase, this can be anywhere from 10 days to 2 days before the actual death. And this is variable. There's people that have listened to me tell this and they've raised their hands and said, my husband died and didn't look like that at all. Other people have said, that's exactly the picture. There's tremendous variation. And the longer I do this, the more variation there is. I used to be pretty good at predicting, and I'm lousy now. But when people reach the active dying phase, very often they are in a coma, either a very deep coma or a thin coma. And sometimes you can arouse them so that they'll open their eyes, and sometimes you can't. No matter what, I think we ought to make sure that we assume they can hear us. Because researchers have found that people can hear right up to the very point that they stop breathing. And we don't know if they hear us after that, too. So I don't know how long it takes for consciousness actually to get out of the body. And so when we're with someone who's in a coma, be very careful that what you're speaking to them are things that you'd want them to hear if you were talking face-to-face, eyeball-to-eyeball. So they may be in a coma, and it may be on various different levels of depth. They may start getting very cold. Very often you'll notice that people's feet are very, very cold. You touch them and it's like an ice cube. They also may start changing color, that their legs may change to you're a Caucasian person, they may be kind of mottled and black and blue looking. Those aren't bruises. That's because the circulation is slowing way, way down. And that usually starts at the feet and then slowly moves up. But again, there's variation. I had one woman who had one leg that was hotter than all get out and the other one was ice cold. Why that happened, I don't know. Because she didn't have any tumors that were cutting off the circulation. It was just an odd variation on it. The other thing that can happen is that people start developing what's called apneic breathing or chain stoke breathing. The nurses here have heard this before, I know. And you've seen it. And apnea can be a very difficult symptom to watch. Can be very hard because what it means is the person breathes real fast for 5 or 6 breaths and then stops. And this can be a long stoppage. The longest I ever saw was 90 seconds. And then they would take 7 real deep breaths or 2 real deep breaths, kind of gasping breaths, and then 90 seconds of apnea. And this went on for hours. So that can be real hard to watch. And again, they say that this is not painful to the person, but I still want to know how they did that research. It just baffles me how they got the research. Because I've tried doing that kind of breathing at home just to see what it feels like, and it feels painful in your chest. So I often recommend to people that they continue to give morphine, they continue to assume that there may be some pain going on, even if someone's in a coma, because we don't know. We do know that pain doesn't stop when you're in a coma, so if you have underlying pathology that's causing the pain, you want to make sure the morphine continues. But when this kind of breathing kicks in too, I always try to recommend to people to give them a very low dose of morphine just in case it's painful. So this apnea is an odd one because it can go on for long periods of time, but it also can be very indicative of the end. So it can be real close. Often they start gurgling too. And again, this is related to the weakness and the profound weakness that just comes right before the dying process. And what that is a collection of secretions right here at the throat that rattle when the breath comes through. And that can sometimes be dried up with medication. But having sat with a lot of people that have been in that position, my gut tells me it's not difficult for them. It's more difficult for me to listen to that, because we don't know what they're feeling. So I often have people try to get real, real quiet when they're sitting with someone who's dying and really try to pay attention to whether or not there's any kind of sign of discomfort or anything of that sort. At the time of death, there is generally a cessation of the breath, that the respirations stop and the heart rate stops, and people have a different look on their face. With the apneic breathing, sometimes it's real hard to know actually what the moment of death is, because when you have these real long periods, 90 seconds, you always say, is this it? And you kind of lean forward in your chair and you watch and your eyes get big and you wait for a long time. So it's hard to know when the exact moment of death is, and it's hard to know also when that person leaves, because I've been with people that I've really felt their consciousness left far before their body stopped. And I've had a sense with other people that they're still there after the heart rate stopped. So again, when you're working with someone or you have a relative or whatever, again, always know that you need to work with them on a position of clarity in your own mind and stillness in your own heart, and watch what you say, because we don't know.